I'm very pleased to have here Anton Lavrov. Anton is an independent defense analyst who is affiliated with the Moscow-based Center for Analysis of Strategies and Technologies and an expert on the Russian military. If you've read any of his work, you know that he is a careful and thoughtful observer of military operations and strategies and how equipment and capabilities are integrated into warfighting and how all of this has changed. He has been a fellow here at CSIS in the Russia-Eurasia program, which I direct. I'm Olga Oleker, by the way, for the last few months, carrying out a project that traces how the Russian armed forces have evolved between the conflict in Georgia in 2008 and the conflict in Syria, which is now ongoing. And this is what he will be presenting the results of here today. There will also be a written report published, I hope, very, very soon. Before we get started, just a quick word that in case of any emergency, I am the person who will provide instructions. You can also follow the exit signs. If we do have to evacuate the building, the location for us to gather is in front of the National Geographic building, which is out the front door to the left and to the left again. But that probably won't happen, and what will happen is a really interesting overview of what Syria and Russian operations in Syria can tell us about where Russia's army, navy, and air force and paratroopers have gotten to in the last 10 years. So, turning it over to Anton.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. First, I want to quickly remind you about another major military conflict with Russia participation. Russia-Georgian war back in 2008 was very brief, only 5 days of active fighting, but it was very intensive. Up to 30,000 of Russian troops were involved, and in Syria now we at any given time have only about 5,000 troops on the ground. Russia and Georgia used its entire arsenal of conventional weapons, including long-range strategic bombers, short-range ballistic missiles, Navy did a landing operation, and several airborne battalions were airlifted from 1,000 kilometers away. Sure, victory was quick and decisive, but against a very weak opponent, and huge problems in Russian military were revealed. And here we are, almost 10 years later, after a painful and turbulent period of reforms in the middle of another major conflict. Syria gave us a good opportunity to see what KNU capabilities the Russian armed force have and have not occurred over these 10 years. In papers about reform of Russian army, usually analyzed new weapons and equipment. But I first want to say about the people of military. As you can see, there have been major changes in composition of Russian armed forces. Today we have much more contract soldiers, twice as many contract soldiers than 10 years ago. Their numbers have already exceeded the number of conscripts. All positions that require technical knowledge, up to truck drivers, now are manned by contract soldiers. The number of officers has decreased, but they are now better prepared and motivated. All sergeant positions since last year are now contractors and have significant benefits. The Russian army is slowly drifting towards the Western modern of professional and highly respected sergeant corps. It's a huge development for Russian forces. We see more and more quality training and realistic exercises, two-side exercises, spot exercises, and so on. Exercise with live weapon. In Syria, many top and middle-level officers gained combat experience in real conflict. In conflict with Georgia, Russian force has had extremely poor situation awareness, like a blind kitties, by the say of one airborne colonel. Military communication were not working. Commander of the army was forced to ask for satellite phone from the correspondence to make a call to headquarters in Moscow. And there was no coordination between different force branches. Ground forces and air forces waged their own wars completely unconnected. From this time, command and control system was rebuilt from the ground up on strategic and tactical levels. Was built a national defense center on the Victory. It's only one of several war rooms and situation rooms of this center. It's a new brain of Russian military. Now, personnel from army, navy, aviation, all works together in one place, in one center. Center has real-time communication with all forces and manage their wartime and peacetime activities from this center in Moscow. They have ability to monitor in real time from drones how cruise missiles strike targets in Syria. It's not a problem anymore. It's made possible a joint battle command system with combined operation of different military branches. In Syria, all combat assets from different branches as well as recon information are controlled by joint headquarters too. On the bottom picture is a situation room in Khmeimim, Russian air base in Syria. Combined and mixed force operation are now a new model for Russian military. Russia is actively developing own version of a joint battle space information system. It includes gathering information from different kinds of sensors and different branch of armed force and target location for all of them from one information space. Basically, it's a Russian version of network-centric warfare. Of course, this system is still in development, but many of its elements already were tested in Syria and used in all major exercises. On tactical level, Russian military invested heavily in modern equipment, communication equipment. And it's quickly replacing outdated analog equipment with modern digital encrypted systems. Strelets, recon control, and communication systems are actively in use now to guide artillery of ground forces and to better interaction of ground forces with air forces and with Navy. It allows the creation of automated tactical battle command systems. And Strelets system and all new communication equipment can relay coordinates, text, images, and even live video from platoon commander or individual Spetsnaz soldiers all the way to headquarters in Khmeimim or even in Moscow. Back in Georgia, Russia don't have a single optical recon satellite on the orbit. Things changed, and from the first day of city operation, more than 10 military remote sensing satellites were used, most of them optical, including two very high definition personal satellites. All they can quickly relay information through radio communications. Four Russian GLONASS constellations in place. It's equivalent of American NAVSTAR GPS system. and used to guide the new Russian precision weapon and to military navigation of planes, ships, and individual vehicles of ground forces. And of course, there's 20 or something communication satellites to do the stuff with automation and joint information battle space and communication. Another crucial asset for better situation awareness for Russian military is drones, of course. Only one outdated UAV was used in Georgia and without any success. Today, Russian military possesses more than 2,500 light Recon UAVs. Every motor rifle brigade have UAVs, some regiments, and of course every division. There is talks and plans about introducing medium-range UAVs in every artillery battalions. UAVs now used even on Navy ships and by Navy aviation. Drones today is a cornerstone of Russian tactics and command and control system. But there are still no male class strike UAVs, sadly. And I think it's a great drawback for Russian forces. You can just look at the losses of Russian helicopters in Syria. A few days ago, we lost another car, Kamov 52, to enemy fire. Now it's seven combat helicopters lost to enemy fire in Syria. All branches of military gained a lot of new equipment. There's a big four of Russian ground forces. Most common new equipment. Main battle tank, infantry fighting vehicle, armored personnel carrier, and self-propelled gun. In the last 10 years, we have procured about 3,000 of it. But as you can see, it's hardly new. It's some modernized version of old Soviet equipment. Of course, good old T-72 get some new armor, fire control system, and communication equipment, but does is enough to stand among the most powerful current and perspective tanks of the world? Probably not. So testing of completely new generation of these equipment types is underway. Armata, Kurganets, Boomerang, Khalitsa are on the horizon. But today, more than 50% of all ground force equipment is still on modernized Soviet-era techniques. Much more improvement within artillery. Ground force received many modern systems with better range, accuracy, and ability to integrate in automated tactical combat systems. We see even a return of heavy artillery and heavy mortars used to strike most hardened targets with precision shells. Even exercise with artillery now includes interaction with drones for target spotting and artillery fire control and fire adjustment. Artillery use more and more guided weapons and guided munitions. Here, for example, is a picture from the Syria when a small Russian drone was used as a spotter and target designator for laser-guided Krasnopol shell. And it was pretty common practice. With the use of automated system, time from target acquisition to target hit by artillery is reduced to just a few minutes. For Russian military, it's a big advancement. It's already tested in Syria and on many exercises. And Russian artillery is now more lethal than ever. One more major improvement for ground forces is the new Iskander ballistic missiles. In Georgia, we used about 2 dozen of Tochka ballistic missiles, but they were used against major strategic targets such as main Navy base of Georgia in Poti. But now, almost all missile brigades were rearmed by much more capable Iskander missiles. With much better accuracy and range now, it's not only an operation-level weapon, but a strategic too. Combination of ballistic and cruise missiles made it especially hard to defend against the new mobile brigade armed with Iskanders. And they are specifically designed to penetrate even anti-ballistic missile defense. Modernization of air forces was a high priority of reform, and they received most of the money for procurement. As a result, in recent years, they have received about 500 of new aircraft and even more new helicopters, about 700 or 800 of helicopters. This is a great achievement by any standards. Most of Air Force today consists of new aircrafts. But most of the money was spent on the purchase of new platforms, planes, and helicopters, and the situation with procurement of guided weapons is much worse. Tactical aviation received new models of powerful guided bombs, but with very short range, and this is clearly not enough. If we will compare with United States air forces, Russian air forces in share of smart weapons today is somewhere between Desert Storm in 91 and Operation Allied Force against Yugoslavia in 99. The need for smart weapons became clear from the operation in Syria, and in new 10-year state armament plan, much more money was allocated to significant increase in procurement of smart weapons. Situation has already improved for strategic aviation. It has no effective non-nuclear weapon vacancy in Georgia in 2008. Now both Tupolev 116 and Tupolev 95 armed with two types of long-range, high-precision cruise missiles, Ha-555 and Ha-101. In Syria was used about 60 such rockets, such missiles, and mostly for testing. It's not from combat necessity. A new generation of precision missiles also in development for Tupolev 22, smaller long-range bombers. Combination of long-range bombers and long-range cruise missiles are handy for force projection, for nuclear and conventional deterrence. And Russian strategic aviation will be the main instrument for this. Air defense of Russian military always was very strong, and in the last years we procured 44 new battalions of new S-400 air defense system. It's nothing new. Of course, it's evolutionary upgrade for air defense capabilities, but new capabilities is ability to protect from short and medium range ballistic missiles. Russia actually bordering with such countries as North Korea, Iran in the sea, and Ukraine. Countries with actively seeking ballistic missile capabilities. So it's having mobile systems to protect is very good convenient measure. But for Russian Navy, situation seems less good. As of today, Russian Blue Water Navy is even smaller in numbers than in 2008 due to lack of procurement, write-off of major combatants, and dire problems with repair and overhaul of ships. On this picture, for example, is a nuclear cruiser Admiral Ushakov. He's in repair for already 18 years and will not be completed until at least 2021. And situation will not be better even in medium and long term. Partly thanks to the disastrous performance of only Russian aircraft carrier in Syria operation, no new aircraft carriers planned in Chinese armament plan, no new large combatants from destroyer size and up, and we see serious problems with production even of modern frigates. Russian Navy turns from blue water ambitions from ocean-going fleet to much more realistic and useful for Russia green water navy, able to defend shores of the country. While there's a problems with big combatants, things are much better with smaller ships and diesel submarines. It takes only 2 or 3 years for Russian industry to build a small corvette or submarine armed with long-range cruise missiles. They are ideally suited to protect Russian coast and still have a surprisingly strong punch for their size. With caliber missiles, first time in history, Russian Navy gains the ability to precision non-nuclear strike against ground targets. In Georgia, Russian Navy can engage ground targets only with guns, no advanced missiles. It's totally new capability, redefining the role of even small ships of Navy. Now they can be useful even in ground operation and low intensity conflicts. In Syria, Russian Navy used more than 100 caliber cruise missiles against ground targets. Navy also received about 50 modern coast-based fighter planes armed with long-range anti-ships and air-to-ground missiles. It's another useful asset for force projection around the borders and to protection of internal waters of Russian Federation. This ability further augmented by a lot of new mobile coastal defense missile systems like BAL and Bastion. And of course, all this new stuff, including planes and coastal missile systems, were tested in Syria. So let's sum up. Key new abilities for Russian military are permanently ready standing army, better personnel, joint combat control system, precision weapons in all branches, better situation awareness thanks to drones and satellites, capable green water navy instead of in place of dysfunctional blue water navy, and a lot of new modern equipment. Pretty impressive. But we have a lot of missing capabilities too. Russia doesn't have blue water navy, doesn't have ability to strategic airlift, program to restore production of medium Ilyushin transport planes met with heavy delays, and no replacement for heavy Antonov transport planes is even on horizon. We don't have landing ships. After the misadventures with Mistral project, there is no replacement or plan B. No ability for air refueling. Number of air tankers is not enough even for strategic bombers alone without tactical aviation. There's no effective reserve system in place. After the reform, Russia lost the ability to expand its forces by mobilization quickly and must now rely only on standing army. Security is higher, but numbers are lower.
And we still don't have a long-range strike UAVs.
Russia today possesses very little ability to long-range power projection, and there is no indication that she actively seeks this ability for the first place. Okay, so Russian military today have better people, equipment, training, just a change strategic balance with NATO. And if we remove nuclear weapons from equation, it's probably not. Yes, in the last 10 years, Russian military progressed faster than NATO overall, gained some crucial military capabilities, improved force projection potential along the borders, and gained some better experience. Today's Russian military is more formidable than ever from the fall of the Soviet Union times. But the most active period of modernization is already behind, and fundamental things do not change. NATO still combined. NATO forces still outnumber and outgun Russian ones by several times in every military branch, except maybe for artillery. Leading NATO armies still technologically superior and have much more real-world combat experience and the ability for global force projection. Economic and manpower potential favorable for Russia. So we, of course, will not see Russian tanks in Paris and Madrid. But invasion in Syria in Russia is an even worse idea than usual, true for any force. So it seems we still have the balance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anton, thank you so much. I thought that was really a great overview with some helpful deep dives. I ought to get a microphone working. I can. Is there something wrong with the microphone? Right, but I got that you can't. I'm talking to the folks in back. We're good? You can hear me? Okay, I feel amplified. Okay, so again, Anton, thank you so much. I thought that was a terrific overview and just the right amount of detail to, I think paint a very useful picture of what Syria can show us. One of the things that I always find interesting when you see new weapons, new technologies being used for the first time. There's kind of two ways it happens, right? Is you're taking a system that's newer than old systems, but you're using it pretty much the same way you use the old systems. And then you have things that actually are new being used in new ways. Or maybe you have things that are old being used in new ways, but things that actually talk about warfare changing. And that's what I want to see if you would like to weigh in on a little bit. We've heard what Syria means for how Russia fights and is likely to fight. What do you think Syria means, if anything, about how warfare is changing in a broader sense?
Syria is a very interesting example of modern conflict. We see there's involved a lot of sites, a lot of world powers, a lot of countries, but no one country of West, of Russia, of big military powers are ready to put the boots on the ground. All of them trying to join combat through the local proxies. I think it will be more and more tendency for the whole conflicts in this region and around the world. We see less and less intentions for use ground forces, but we see that Western countries, Russia, and our great military powers want to use their technically superiority to
to fight, and local forces to do territory control. It's an interesting development. Back in 20 years ago, maybe, United States was ready to put the ground, boots on the ground in Iraq, in Afghanistan. It was no problem. And now it's a much more serious problem. And it's a problem now even for Russia. We too don't want to send Russian peoples, to send Russian soldiers to fight somewhere very far from home.
Is it a problem? I mean, or is it just an evolution? Is it in any way preventing Russia from accomplishing what it wants to accomplish in Syria?
Even in Russia, we must be here. We must even Russian leadership must hear the peoples, and people don't want big military involvement in somewhere with high casualties. And without high casualties, with high technology warfare, it's another matter. Mm-hmm. Russian peoples can sustain this for a long periods. It's not so many combat awareness, war awareness as for now. And the conflict in Syria for Russia is already for 2 and almost 3 years.
And just to take that one step further, if the future of warfare both is driven in part by domestic public opinion and by the technological capability that makes it possible to cater to that domestic public opinion to avoid large-scale commitments of ground forces. Despite this, we, in terms of Russian investment, we see some investment in these sorts of things, but we also still see a great deal of investment in ground forces, in ground capabilities. So that suggests that Russia isn't convinced that this is the new way of war.
It's a Russian way. It's a Russian way of thinking. Russia still fear invasion from beyond the borders. It's still a cornerstone of Russian strategy to be able to defend its vast territory from any external forces or coalition of forces. It's something of historical experience.
I understand that, but if your external coalition of forces is also going to use air power and is not going to put boots on the ground, then what good are all those tanks and artillery? And
invasion is meant when not only bombing campaign, it's when enemy armies actually going to your ground.
Okay. For your territory. And how likely do you think that is? That somebody's going to invade Russia?
I think it's highly unlikely. Okay. but it's still historical lessons. And as you remember here, Gerasimov doctrine, that against Russia can be used hybrid warfare.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, yeah. Ground forces still need it to control territory, to defend territory, and we still need a lot of equipment to cover our vast distances.
All right, I'm going to give our capable audience the floor, and Steve, I think, had his hand up first. Please do identify yourself, please do ask a question.
2 points or questions. Oh, Stephen Black, American Foreign Policy Council. 2 questions. Excellent presentation. Olga just pointed out, that the emphasis on ground warfare might be misplaced. But wouldn't you say that from the force structure you have described, it looks like Russia is thinking that the main war that it has to be concerned about, the main contingency, is a war on its borders, around the CIS. And for that, you need lots of ground troops in order to occupy land and affect a strategic political outcome. The second question is, You mentioned in your talk at a number of points network-centric warfare. You described systems that look very much like what Ogarkov used to talk about 30, 40 years ago, reconnaissance strike capabilities. To what degree is this a self-conscious adaptation, A, of Ogarkov's thinking, and B, of the American concept of network-centric warfare?
I will first answer second question. I think we have partly old Soviet views and partly learned from recent examples by Western forces, recent conflicts. And in Syria, Russian forces can see from the first row and how NATO, how United States forces waged the war, how used aviation assets. It's very educational experience. It's Russian military can learn much about from it. So I think it's a combination of transformation of Soviet views and things learned from recent Western capabilities and Western experience. And first questions, can you?
Aren't the ground forces useful for occupation?
Yeah, they're effective for, well, not just occupying ground, but to make a strategic political transformation
along the borders of the
Russian
Federation.
Is Russia planning to invade other countries with its ground forces and then occupy them?
For example, Donbass.
I think Russia seems that conflicts, some local conflicts around the borders, is possible. It's a lesson from the conflicts with Georgia, when a small post-Soviet republic with not very strong military threw a military challenge for Russia. Russian military command thinks that ground forces still can be used for defending of territory and for projection of power on near abroad.
But do you think that the force structure, I mean, I do think it's important to differentiate between attack and occupation, right? And this occupation is a different matter than seizing territory. Does Russia have capacity to occupy territory?
Russia has limited capacity to occupy large territory. For occupy large territory, you need a large army, not best trained maybe, but just large. Old Russian army 10 years ago was maybe even better prepared for this task. Now it's good professional soldiers that are too costly to use this in this task. But of course, when you have effective army, it's easy to project power.
Okay. All right, let's just go straight back.
Hi, Richard Weitz. I agree, Hatsunensu, excellent presentation, very clear. I had a question about, you mentioned the S-400 having capabilities against short and intermediate range systems. Have we have any evidence how capable these systems are? I know when we were just considering the Syrian strike, there was some concern about the S-300. Now the S-400 is very active. The S-500 is coming in line. They each have some stated effectiveness against missiles, cruise, and ballistic. But I haven't really seen any evidence how they've been doing in terms of test record or actual military performance, if any.
When we say about United States military, it's the most powerful military in the world, and it's very hard to protect against strikes by United States when you only on defense with any kind of air defense systems, be it C-400, be it Patriot, be it something Israel made. You just can't defend against thousands of cruise missiles and thousands of airplanes. But Russian military threats, military threat to Russia and military armies of the world is not limited to United States and NATO. Russia has much more another concern from North Korea to, and China to Ukraine and Georgia. And for this type of conflicts, Russian air defense is very impressive. In Syria, we don't see a single launch of S-400 missiles, but Pantsir short-range missiles were in actively in use, and it was used against protection even a new type of attack by swarm of strike drones, bomber drones, and it was pretty successful. I think air defense systems and development of air defense systems are very important for Russia, and it will be contained, and it will contain.
Okay, let's move up front here.
Peter Humphrey, I'm an intel analyst and a former diplomat. One of the things that's unfolding in Russia is sort of this flat population, and then within that flat population, an increasingly Muslim percentage. And when we do demographic projections, it gets pretty weird out in the future, to the point where you can think about a Muslim majority Russia at the end of this century. Already, we see recruits entering the armed forces disproportionately Muslim, that is to say, more than the 21%. That represents the population as a whole. And that's probably because, you know, these guys are looking for economic opportunity, I'll go join the army. So, you know, maybe 21% of the population is Muslim, 35% of the military. And that's going to get worse through time. Is there resistance on the part of Russia to send Muslim troops to conflicts involving Muslims? And that's going to be on the perimeter or even in Syria.
I might just challenge you to say that a higher Muslim proportion is not necessarily worse. It's just a higher percentage of Muslims.
I don't think it's a major factor in Russia. Russia is a
secular state,
and it's no Orthodox Christians nor Muslims don't have much influence in political and military decisions. But Muslim populations and battalions formed from Muslims of North Russian North Caucasus were very useful in Syria as a military police. They can quickly establish contacts with local population because most of Russian Muslims are Sunni, and they even have good contacts with rebel Syrians. I don't think Muslim population is a problem. It's useful, active for Russian, and it's used in Syria, actually.
But the church has been more involved in the Russian military in recent years.
Who?
The church, the Orthodox Church, and religion in general. First, you have chaplains, but also the church has been pairing up with units. I mean, this is actually...
Yes. We have some priests in units, but it's not changed anything, I think.
All right.
Wayne Mary, the American Foreign Policy Council. 2 points I'd like you to discuss, please. The first is, would you elaborate a bit more on the future of the reserve system? I mean, you noted there's no longer an aspiration for mass mobilization, but a good reserve system is necessary for sustainability of operations. on any scale. And I'm wondering what you see as being the development, say, in the next 5 to 7 years of the reserve system. And second, one thing that you didn't talk about is the role, at least in doctrine or planning, of non-strategic nuclear weapons in terms of protecting...
I think that's because he was talking about Syria.
Well, but we were also talking about the border, Russia's borders with the West and in the East. And in terms of securing those borders, certainly non-strategic nuclear weapons do play a very important role in Russia's overall military strategy. And I'm wondering if you would comment on that. Not in Syria.
Okay. Let me first say about a reserve. It's a problem, and there is no good solution still. There is some experiments, some ideas, but there is no no solution. Russia has Russian military want fully professional army, maybe, but they don't have a good mechanism for reserve in this case. So. At least for now, it was decided to keep a mixed structure of forces with mix of conscripts and professional soldiers. Conscripts who serve 20 months, gain basic military training, and can be and can constantly fill the reserve. They can be a reserve. And of course, we have former professional soldiers after demobilization, after the end of contracts, who can be mobilized in case of necessity. And for the non-nuclear, non-strategic nuclear weapons, I'm not in any. And a great expert of expert on nuclear weapons, but I do not see any use of non-nuclear tactical, non-strategic tactical nuclear weapons in recent exercises. I think it's not a part of current doctrine. Of course, we still have a big amount of tactical nukes, but it's something for the worst case scenario. It's not something of military, day-to-day military training.
Okay.
Oleg Mirkulov, Business Baltia Media Group from Riga, Latvia. First question, what is the role of private military companies like ČVK Wagner in Syria, and how well do they coordinate their actions with the regular Russian army? And second, do you agree with some assessments that it would take, God forbid, it happens, only about 3 days for Russian army to go all the way to Riga, all the way to Baltics? Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very interesting question about Wagner and other private military companies. I think it's not a proper name for them, private military companies. We have several established private military companies who do job of escorting ships against pirates and protecting some assets in Afghanistan and Iraq. But Wagner is a completely different thing. It's more like a mercenary company of old Renaissance Europe. They are not part of military. They are working for the money of, and they initially was hired by Syrian oligarchs to protect some oil and gas assets in Syria. And after that, they was used in assault operations against ISIS. There's not many good infantry on the ground in Syria, so every company of soldiers can matter in fight against small groups of terrorists and rebels. We don't know how well connected are Russian military in Syria and Wagner military and Wagner company. I'm sure that mostly they on their own they works independently. Maybe in when last year when combat was with ISIS in the desert regions, some special operation forces were integrated with Wagner to help them with airstrikes. But I think now it's against disengaging. And again, about your second questions, it's not Russian assessment of these 3 days. It's from Western sources, and I think it's mostly untrue, because in near the border with the Baltic states, we don't have major military presence of ground forces, comparing to North Caucasus. Or border with Ukraine, maybe. We don't have troops to capture Baltic in 3 days. All Western military districts in this region have about less than 100 tanks. Two tank battalions. And near, that's all.
Hi, Colin Smith, DOD. Thank you again for your presentation. You commented on the naval forces' successful use of caliber weapons in Syria and also on the lack of really having an amphibious assault ship capability, like helicopter carriers. But can you comment on any lessons learned using their amphibious shipping from Crimea for naval infantry to Syria? I know they were using a lot of different, the older anti-tank ships, but any lessons learned from those that portion of the operation?
It's something different. Russian Navy and Russian military use amphibious assault ships, assault landing ships, to ferry troops, equipment from Russia to Syria because they don't have anything else. They don't have strong support fleet. It was forced to buy old civilian ships and convert them to support transport ships, military ships. It's just because we don't have another alternative. You can airlift 400 or 500 of troops without a long voyage on landing ship. You can just fly them in Khmeimim. It's two or three planes. And you don't need such assault ships, and you don't need Mistral-class ship for this. Russian mostly will mostly used for transport of large amount of people and equipment, aviation, and ground routes, railroads, and something like this. We don't need much Navy assets for this.
Okay. Right here.
Hi, my name is Donna Amadi. I'm an International Affairs Fellow with the Council of American Ambassadors. My question is regarding the naval bases that have been instituted in Tartus, for example, the long-range agreements that are now taking place between the Russian military within Syria. And I'm interested in hearing your commentary on how this may affect Russian security projection along the Mediterranean and how it may impact their ability to influence greater within the area.
Sorry, Mark Walter.
So the Russia planning to maintain bases in Syria, how that's going to affect Russia's presence in the region more broadly?
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Russia don't have many foreign bases, and of course, and can project power only around the borders. And Syria is an only place we can where Russia can stay. Place their bases and project force around them, not from border, but from bases. And of course, it will be a very useful instrument for force projection and to control of entire region. Maybe not Mediterranean Sea, but in Europe, but Middle East, and Suez Canal. And Persian Gulf, it can be useful. Iraq, it will be. It's why Russia is so interested in Syria and supporting Bashar Assad, because it's only opportunity to gain a foothold on this region.
Vitaly Kozarev, Endicott College. There are many publications saying that most of the recent technological breakthroughs have been just the usage of the shelved Soviet inventions and technological research and development results. So can you just comment on this in terms of the how robust the potential of the current research and development of the Russian military-industrial complex is? Especially given the fact that the opportunities to import technologies are limited due to sanctions, and even if you compare with China, for example, which invests tremendous amounts of money to research and development. So, what's the state of affairs in the Russian research and development in this field? Thank you.
Thank you. Of course, current Russia research and development capacity is much less than in Soviet times. And when a lot of money was put on procurement of after the Georgia war, first move was to take from the shelf all Soviet technology undeveloped and rebuild them. And develop, complete their development. We see it's in planes, in tanks, in some tanks, but now it's a new generation of new platform, not on based on Soviet research and development, such as this is a new tanks. New infantry fighting vehicles and APCs, new drones. It's completely Russian. It's not Soviet technology. Iskander missiles and recent technologies presented by President Putin, like laser protection systems. And kinjal missiles, and all this is new. But you're right. Inability to gain access to Western technologies after the sanction will cripple for some period Russian ability to military innovation. It can be substituted, but it's a real slow development for several years.
Great.
Hi, I'm Andy Wright with the British Embassy. Two questions for you. The first one with regards to sustainability. You talked a lot about the rapid rise in capability across all the militaries in various areas. One might say it's disproportionate compared to the economy of Russia at the moment. So is this continual improvement of the Russian military sustainable? And how will that compare with NATO over the long run? And secondly, you've talked about a lack of appetite for expeditionary ops, but you haven't talked about the high north at all. And I just wonder if you might make a comment on Russia's ambitions there. Thanks.
Sorry, Russia's ambitions in
the high north,
Arctic.
No. For some reasons, high Arctic is a part of Russian strategic targets for military modernization. I don't see much threats on this region for Russia. But its investment in this region are still not very big compared to investment in army in general, in nuclear forces, and in conventional forces in other regions of Russia. So I think it will not be very bothersome, very heavy for Russia to keep current plans of high Arctic. About ability to sustain, Russia still have military budget. It's somewhat on decline, but it was planned a hit several years ago, and we don't see any limitation in budget. Actually, Russia was forced to abandon some most ambitious projects like a carrier, like nuclear-powered cruisers and destroyers, but they was not realistic anyway. And now was corrected targets for professional army from target of 4,500 professional soldiers in next years. And now it's only 400,000 of professional soldiers for in plans. And I think even with current budget, 70% of it on new equipment procurement. You have a big space to maneuver, to allocate more money for personnel if you need, scrap only few programs on equipment. I think Russian budget and current army is sustainable.
Hi, I'm Alex Ippoliti. Question about logistics sustainment for Russian forces in Syria, especially how that compares to the Georgian conflict, being Russia's first expeditionary, Russia's first expeditionary effort.
So logistics, just kind of what the logistics chain is that the
right? Question? I was just wondering if you could please talk about Russia's logistics and their support to forces in Syria.
Actually, it says that Russia still don't have ability to sustain LH contingents long on far from the borders. Even small contingent of 5,000 of people and less than 100 of planes and helicopters put to the limits Russian logistic capabilities. So I think we don't have ability to sustain somewhere in Syria, say 20,000 of people of army, or even smaller amount in even farther away territories.
Yes, it's Syria put Russian military logistics to its limits.
Okay. More questions?
Justin Ziegler from UC Santa Cruz. You talked a lot about the new networks that the Russian military was coming online with. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about any doctrine responses or training that the Russian military is doing in case those networks are jammed and their chain of command is cut off from the headquarters that coordinates all of the branches together. Thank you.
So how does Russia plan to respond if it is faced with an adversary that can limit, you know, that can interfere with its networks?
Mm-hmm. It's a challenge for any modern military. But I think, of course, it's worth claiming by Russian military that all these new systems are completely protected from any interference. But of course, the Russian never have experience of doing against adversary with strong electronic warfare capability, against opponents with similar communication capability. So we don't know. We don't have experience with this. I think, of course, it will be very important aspect of any future military combat between technologically advanced countries.
All right. I thought this was terrific. Anton, thank you so much for joining us, for presenting your research. I'm really looking forward to reading the final report, and I'm sure the audience is as well.
More in depth.
I think this is going to be a real contribution. So thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you.